Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Bruce Dickey Show here on AM 1390 and WFIW-FM Fairfield, Illinois. Appreciate you tuning in this morning. This is one of my favorite shows every year. I don't know how many years we've done this show. Three, four, six, seven, 8 years. Four? This is the fourth time? He's holding up a hand to me. This is making his fourth appearance on the show. Traditionally, on my last live show of the year, which is today. Last live interview of the year for 2016. I am joined by my good friend of those who have no friends, Mr. M. Eric Matt Vaughn. How you doing, Matt?
Good morning, Bruce. Merry Christmas to our fans and listeners.
Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas to those folks as well, I guess. I probably have said that a time or two. It's no big deal saying it often. How are you doing today?
I'm fine.
I'm so glad you're here.
We're not going to talk about Abraham Lincoln or the Civil War today, Bruce.
You see, that's the thing. I built you up today. I promoted you as a you know, we're going to talk Abraham Lincoln. Here it comes.
I've defamed Mary Todd Lincoln enough. It's time to move on. We've got a new topic. But what remains consistent, a lot of my shows have been about Southern Illinois legends and lore. This fits in that category. We have a story about Southern Illinois that I think folks will like.
So you go around collecting these stories of Southern Illinois, or how do you happen upon the subjects that you wish to talk about?
Years ago, I read a book called The Pitch That Killed, and it has a Southern Illinois connection. That's why I'm here today. And I'd lead off by asking Bruce, in your mind, you're a sports guy.
Yes, I am.
What are the biggest stories in sports that have a Southern Illinois connection in the history of Southern Illinois? I define Southern Illinois as that which is below I-70.
I would say below I-70, Gary Gaetti's from Centralia, won the World Series with the Twins. If you look, you could probably say you're over the SIU guy, so
yeah, the 1967 SIU team winning the NIT, which was a big deal back then. That tournament was bigger than the NCAA tournament in 1967.
I think the Evansville Aces winning the NCAA Division II a couple of times with a little Southern Illinois connection with Jerry Sloan.
And then the tragic air crash with the El Dorado connection.
University of Evansville in 1977 air crash.
Probably the biggest of all the stories is Jackie Joyner Kersee winning Olympic gold in how many different sets of Olympics?
84, 88, and I don't think she won in 96. I think she won in 92. I don't think she won in 96.
That's probably the story. I would suggest what I'm going to really talk about today is number two on the list.
Really?
Yeah.
And we haven't mentioned it.
Yeah. Let's talk about it.
Tell me about it.
With any good story.
How about Ray Fosse getting hit by Pete Rose?
That's up there, too, in the All-Star game in 1970.
70.
Yeah.
1970.
I'm going to talk about another violent encounter in Major League Baseball. This happened in 1920, and it's quite the story.
And 96 years ago.
As with any story, there's a hero, and there's a villain. And
really?
We're going to lead off with a villain.
No kidding.
The villain's name is Carl Mays. He was born in Liberty, Kentucky. His father was a Methodist minister, died at age 12, left behind 5 sons, 3 daughters, very poor family, and according to Carl, he had a rough-and-tumble upbringing to put food on the table. They couldn't afford a gun or bullets for a gun, so he would kill squirrels with rocks. That's the story.
Hold on.
That's the story, Bruce. That's part of the legend, part of the lore.
Of Carl Mays.
Yeah.
Is he related to Willie?
No, not at all.
Okay.
When he eventually became a big league ball player, but on his way up through the minor leagues, when he left home in Kentucky, his mom made him promise that he would never play baseball on a Sunday. Well, Carl, being the despicable guy that he was,
Carl was despicable.
Honored that vow until he got to the big leagues, and he promptly forgot it.
Carl is despicable. Why? How do we know Carl's despicable?
Because he was the most
because he's killing squirrels.
He and Ty Cobb were the most hated players in the American League in the teens and 20s.
Okay,
There's no doubt about it.
I know that. I've always heard that about Ty Cobb and read that about Ty Cobb.
He feuded with Ty Cobb all the time. One game, Cobb positioned a bunt in such a way that the pitcher would have to cover first base. And when Cobb approached first base on the rundown on the bunt, he leapt into the air and purposely spiked Carl Mays.
No!
And Ty Cobb told Mays.
Ty Cobb did that?
Yes.
No way!
Cobb told Mays at the time, quote, "The next time you cover the bag, I'll take the skin off the other leg." Baseball was a different sort of breed of sport than it is now, less refined back then than it is now.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now it's much more. It's a sedentary art now.
Compared to then, I mean, Carl Mays was a headhunter. He threw high and tight. He had the reputation of brushing back pitchers. He routinely led the league in hitting batsmen, as they were called back then. And by the late teens, he was the most hated player in the American League with Ty Cobb. What was unique about Mays is he had a funky delivery. He would throw submarine style underhand. In fact, as Baseball Magazine in 1918 put it, quote, Carl slings the pill from his toes. He has a weird-looking windup, and the action looks like a cross between an octopus and a bowler. He shoots the ball in at the batter at such unexpected angles that his delivery is hard to find, generally until 5 o'clock, when the batters get accustomed to it and when the game is about over. It was common for Hayes, when he brought the pitch in on the submarine style, that his knuckles would drag the ground. That's
really
how low he's getting. He did that by leaning over and concealing the ball with his back to the batter and then bringing it low.
So you're looking at a Kent Tekulve, Dan Quisenberry style.
It's more exaggerated than that. There were only one or two submarine pitchers in the league at that time. He was the most prominent. To make matters worse in terms of being hated in the American League, Mays was a sullen and moody loner. One fellow player was quoted as saying, quote, the man who looked as if he always had a toothache. Teammates hated him.
Yeah, was he good, though?
He was very good. He put up Hall of Fame-type numbers, and we'll touch upon later why he's not in the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Carl Mays and Babe Ruth came up together from the minor leagues at the same time.
I'm looking at his stats here. He played for Boston, the Red Sox.
Yes, he did. He came up with Boston in 14 with Ruth. He feuded with Ruth. He didn't get along with anyone. He, as I mentioned earlier, he was not a well-liked player on the team. He belittled infielders when they made an error in the field. And he took a dim view of anyone who drank, caroused, or womanized. Now, back then, that's what big league ball players did. They had a lot of free time on their hands on the road.
Well, they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do.
Do they?
But it's not common for a teammate to call you out.
Oh, really?
More than once, Ruth and Mays almost came to blows when they were on the Red Sox.
Well, they same
age? Who's a bigger carouser than Babe Ruth in 1915?
I would think nobody.
That's right.
He wasn't married yet. I'm looking here at their ages, and Mays is probably about 4 years older than Ruth at this point. Okay.
Ruth got shot through the minor leagues because he had something that nobody else did back then. He could hit the long ball.
Yeah,
this
power
is the dead ball era. Carl Mays in 18 led the league with 30 complete games. On Memorial Day in 1919, we had an incident where Carl Mays ran afoul of the law. While in Philadelphia, the visiting team dugout had a tin roof.
Okay.
And it was common for the fans to get liquored up and pound on the roof.
No!
Of the visiting team dugout.
No!
Yes, it happened.
Really?
Carl Mays didn't like that. And in the middle of the game, he popped out of the dugout and slung a ball into the air, which grazed a woman, and broke the straw hat of a person who happened to have political connections in Philadelphia, who promptly went to the authorities. An arrest warrant was issued for Mays, and the warrant was not served for years and years. For years.
He would go to Philadelphia?
Regardless of what team he's on, be it at the time the Boston Red Sox or later the Yankees, he couldn't go to Philadelphia because there's an outstanding warrant.
That's great.
Yeah. And we talk about lawlessness now.
Yeah, yeah. See, now that's pretty cool. If you have a guy in the league that can't go to an entire town.
He can't
go to an entire city in the league. There's only eight teams in the league, so he can only play six other teams rather than seven.
You know, and if I arrange something where my clients are avoiding service on a warrant, I'd be arrested for obstructing justice. But the monolith that is eventually the New York Yankees got away with it.
Oh, yeah.
The American League president fined him $100 for incident. By that time, he'd fell out of favor with the Boston manager. The Boston manager told him to go fishing, and that became a byword of Mays for years. I'm going fishing. He left the team. The Boston Red Sox players gathered and prepared a written statement basically saying, that suits us fine.
Is this 19?
Yes, this is 19.
Okay.
We don't want him to come back, even though he was having a decent year. Enter the New York Yankees. Around that same time, ownership of the Yankees had passed to Colonel Houston, Colonel Rupert of Yankee lore. They had something previous Yankees owners didn't have, cash. They bought Carl May's contract, this outlaw, for $40,000 and threw in some third-rate players. That's the villain of her story, Carl Mays.
Okay, now I was thinking, I would have thought that Colonel Rupert might have been the... He's always been the villain of a lot of stories. Maybe for Boston fans, he's the villain because he...
Yeah, that we're going to get to that.
Are we getting to that?
Yeah, we're going to turn... Eventually. Yeah, we're going to turn to our hero now. Our hero now is a Southern Illinois boy.
Okay.
His name's Ray Chapman. Though he's born in Beaver Dam, Kentucky, that's not far from Southern Illinois. As a boy, he moved to Heron. He considered himself a Southern Illinoisan. He considered himself a native of Williamson County and a native of Heron. His father worked in the mines around Heron and later became town constable in Heron. Ray Chapman was just the opposite of Carl Mays. He was cheerful, outgoing, and friendly. The most well-liked player on his team,
really?
Wherever he was.
No kidding.
He was a humble person. For the rest of his life, he worked in the mines in Heron. For the rest of his life, he carried his union card among his belongings. He wanted that union card to remind him of his humble beginnings.
See, now they didn't have a union in baseball then at that point.
No, they did not.
No.
He got to start playing ball with a semi-pro team in Heron. He had a stint with a semi-pro team in Mount Vernon, Illinois. We don't know a lot about that. We don't know a lot about the statistics. But he played in Mount Vernon for a semi-pro team. A pro scout caught his eye.
He caught the eye of a pro scout.
That's right. And he signs a pro contract with Springfield of the 3I League. Springfield, Illinois.
Yeah.
Now, Bruce, when I say 3I League, what do the 3Is stand for?
Independent Initiative in Illinois.
No. People. Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana.
Oh, okay.
It's a minor league team based in those three states. The 3I League was a diverse bunch. I get a kick out of some of the team names.
Was this one of the ones that the Moonlight Graham would have played on in Field of Dreams?
I don't know. This would have been a very low-level minor league team,
okay.
Or minor league, though connected with the major leagues. It was a Class D is what they called it back
sure.
then.
Sure.
I love some of the team names. The Evansville River Rats, the Decatur Commodores for that noted seafaring town, Decatur.
Yeah.
The Terre Haute Hottentots, the Peoria Distillers.
I like the Hottentots.
The Springfield Senators, my favorite, the Moline Plowboys, who were perennial losers in the 3I League.
It sounds like if you're a plowboy.
The 3I League had a reputation as being a very rough and tumble outfit. Once, when Ty Cobb was asked to assess the toughness of a particular umpire, he was quoted as saying, quote, "He licked somebody in the 3I League. He ought to do," unquote.
Hold on. All right.
I mean, it was a different era.
It's a different era. We're going to talk a little bit more about Ray Chapman when we get back here. You're listening to the Bruce Dickey Show. I've got Matt Vaughn, and you're listening on AM 1390 and WFIW-FM Fairfield. We'll be back in a minute. Morning, folks. Welcome back to the Bruce Dickey Show here on AM 1390 WFIW-FM, Fairfield, Illinois. Appreciate you tuning in this morning. My guest across the way is Matt Vaughn. We've been talking about Ray Chapman, and you were saying, by the way, he had a great question during the break, wondering if Ray Chapman is related to Rex Chapman, the former Kentucky basketball player, and we don't know, do we?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a great question.
That is a great question.
Because Rex Chapman, we've learned, it was from Beaver Dam, Kentucky, like Ray Chapman.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And I know he had Ray Chapman left behind some aunts and uncles in the Beaver Dam area.
He played high school ball in Owensboro. So, I mean, yeah. Anyway, we were talking
about Ray Chapman. He's in the 3I League, and big league scouts notice him.
Okay.
Cleveland buys his contract for $1,000 from the Davenport Prodigals of the 3I League.
The Davenport Prodigals. That's a great name.
That's a household name.
Yeah, that's a great name.
And he spends another year in the 3I League, with the AAA team of the Cleveland Indians, the Toledo Mudhens, in 1911. In 1912, about the last month of 1912, he gets the call to the show. Cleveland summons him up for the last month of the season, and he does very well. He plays in 31 games, bats .312, again in the dead ball era. Ray Chapman's days in the mines are over. He is a big league ball player. He returns to Heron as a celebrity. The city fathers award him job as sidewalk inspector, which, as I understand it, was something of an honorific back then.
Sidewalk inspector.
They gave him some money. And he was quoted in a local paper as saying, quote, "This preliminary taste of politics just whetted my appetite for more. Guess I'll be mayor of Heron when I grow up and retire from baseball." He goes back, plays for the Indians 13, 14, 15, 16, has some injuries. In 1917, though, he is a full-fledged Major League Baseball star. Yeah. He bats .302, scores, or has 98 runs scored. More importantly, he sets a Major League Baseball record for 67 sacrifice hits, which shattered the old record by some 15.
I probably get a lot of RBIs.
This record still stands. Now,
really?
If you go to the Major League Baseball website now,
like sacrifice
see,
bunts, you mean? Sacrifice
they, it's
bunts?
Called sacrifice hits, which could mean pushing the runner over in any given situation. Not to be confused with sacrifice flies. That's a different category. This we're talking about bunts and the like. At that time, he was considered the greatest shortstop in Major League Baseball since Honest Wagner. And he also set a Cleveland Indians record for the most stolen bases in a career, which was on the books until 1980 when it was broken. Baseball season ended early in 1918 due to the war. He enlisted in the Naval Reserves after the armistice of World War I in November of 18. He is released from his naval obligation. At the end of the 1919 season, Chapman decides to marry a girl in Cleveland who was the daughter of an oil magnate, a millionaire.
No kidding!
Which very much disappointed his mother, who wanted him to marry a good home Southern Illinois gal.
Is that right?
It was. And by this time, Mr. Chapman, this Southern Illinois boy, is the toast of the town in Cleveland, Ohio, which was then the sixth largest city in the United States. The 1919 season, Cleveland battles the famous.
They lose to the Black Sox.
Lose to the Black Sox by 3.5 games. Chapman attended that World Series. He came back.
Really?
He came back home to and told his family in Heron, "There's something not right about that World Series. I don't know what happened, but there is something that is off kilter."
Because he had seen the Black Sox. He played against the White Sox 25 games that year.
Yeah. And he knew something was wrong. He gets married in October of 19. His father-in-law wants him out of baseball, and he basically tells Chapman, "Baseball is not the career you should have if you're going to settle down and be a good family man." When he's back in Heron, he tells his family, "I'm going to play in 20 because Tris Speaker is going to be the manager of the Indians then. I like our team. Cleveland's never won a pennant. We're going to win the pennant in 20.
There you go.
I'm going to get the pennant for my good friend Tris Speaker. I'm going to bring the pennant to Cleveland. I got one more year in the bigs, and then I'm going to work for my father-in-law."
Oh, no. Not the old movie thing. It's one more job before I retire.
Yes.
That's always the worst thing you can say.
It is like a 1940s movie, isn't it,
it's
Bruce?
It's terrible.
Yeah. In 1920.
Like a Bruce Willis movie or something like that.
He's back in Heron visiting the family. Now, think about this for a moment. In 1920, the Indians' spring training facility was in New Orleans. If you're in Cleveland, how do you get to New Orleans then?
Cleveland, you'd probably take the train.
You take the train to Chicago, and you come down Illinois Central, goes through Carbondale, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
So, there it is. March 3, 1920, Ray Chapman and his family from Heron go to the train station to get on the train in Carbondale. And as he's getting on the train, he turns to look at his family, and he waves at them goodbye. And it's the last time they're going to see him alive. Now, at the risk of sounding melodramatic, I'm in Carbondale a lot. And when I drive by the town square area where the old train station used to be, it's almost like I can see this.
No kidding.
The fateful Ray Chapman getting on the train, waving goodbye to his home folks.
It's north of where the current train station is, right?
I would suspect it would be the square. In downtown Carbondale.
That's not the end of it, but that's coming.
There are other things going on in the off-season of 19 and 20 that have an impact on her story. In 1919, the Boston Red Sox sell the contract of Babe Ruth to the Yankees for $125,000 and a loan of $300,000 where the Yankees owners retain a mortgage on Fenway Park.
Now, that I didn't know. I didn't know they had the mortgage on Fenway.
They held the mortgage to Fenway for a loan. The owner of the Red Sox at the time was an up-and-down playwright named...
He did No-No Nanette.
Harry Frazee.
Right, Harry Frazee, right.
And he needed the money to finance some ventures in entertainment.
No, no, Nanette.
Was that the play that failed?
That was the play.
Okay. To put it all in perspective, what's $125,000 back then? Babe Ruth, who was the most prominent player in the big leagues, his contract for that year was $10,000. He wanted to double his salary, and Harry Frazee said no. And by the way, we're going to sell you to the Yankees. He had hit 33 home runs in 19. Boston as a team hit 33 home runs. The Babe had 29 of those.
And he was still pitching.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes he was. What's unique about this situation is the hated Carl Mays and Babe Ruth are teammates again for their hated New York Yankees.
Probably the rest of their careers.
The other thing that happened in the offseason is Major League Baseball began to crack down on doctored pitches. We think of the spitball in this day and age.
It's also the end of the dead ball era, pretty close.
19 is considered the end of the dead ball era. We consider spitballs to be the doctored pitch. It was way more complicated than that. What pitchers really like to do is rough up the ball. And they would only use one or two balls a year. Per game.
They'd get them back on the foul balls. You didn't get to keep a foul ball back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was common for a ball to get soft as the game went on and harder to hit, and it favored the pitchers.
Much like modern-day wiffle ball games, Matt Vaughn.
A lot like that. Good analogy. The commissioner cracked down on this, but as the season went on in 1920, the owners kind of rebelled against this policy of replacing the balls throughout the game.
It cost them too much?
That's exactly right. The balls cost $2.50, and the owners complained about that, so they stopped supplying as many new balls for the umpires to put into play.
So they were getting darker and darker.
That's right.
Oh, that's why whenever you go to a museum or something, you see these tremendously dark baseballs.
That's part of the reason, I'm sure.
Age, too.
The 1920 season is a memorable season. The Indians, White Sox, and Yankees are in a pennant race. The Yankees have never won a pennant. The Indians have never won a pennant. As the year went on, rumors started persisting in big league circles that there was something wrong about that 1919 World Series. In September, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office convened a grand jury to investigate the matter. An indictment was returned against 8 White Sox players for fraud. What's curious about this, and forget about the movie for a second, the movie makes you think that the victim of this fraud was some fan who was somehow cheated out of gambling earnings because the White Sox threw the World Series. That's not the case. The actual victim named in the indictment was another White Sox player who was not involved in the conspiracy to throw the series.
Really?
But who had lost out on the winning share of World Series proceeds.
Who was it?
It was a reserve infielder. I forget the name
of him. Not Gleason. He's the manager, but
the White Sox, after that indictment came out, were a distracted bunch. They finished 2 games out. In August of 1920, August 16th of 1920, there's a critical game between the Indians and the Yankees. There is no Yankee Stadium then. It's in the old Polo Grounds. And at that time, the Yankees are a half game behind the Indians for first place in the American League. Ray Chapman's having the best season
He's having a big career.
He's batting .304, 97 runs scored at the end of the dead ball era. That's something. 52 walks, 27 doubles, 49 RBIs, which is incredible for somebody batting in the 2 slot.
Yeah.
Great numbers. He's considered the best bunter in the American League. He's leading the league in sacrifice hits. In June, he had played in his 1,000th game in the big leagues. And by July and August, he's telling anyone who'll listen that his wife is pregnant.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
He's 29 years old.
Oh.
Carl Mays has had a rough season in 29.
Oh, no. This is going bad.
Even by Carl Mays standards, he's getting into a lot of disputes with other teams in the league. There was this notorious incident at Old Sportsman Park in St. Louis where he brushes back a Browns player. There's a near riot, and Carl Mays is right in the middle of that. On this day of the big game in August of 1920, Carl Mays is going for his 100th victory in the big leagues. The afternoon, it's rainy and dark.
I'm going to hold you right now. We're going to tell what happens. This is bad.
It's not good, Bruce.
This is not good. We'll be back on the Bruce Dickey Show right after this.
been thinking lately about the people I meet. The car wash on the corner and the hole in the street. The way my ankles hurt with shoes on my feet. And I'm wondering if I'm gonna see tomorrow. Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn blue. Then we'll whistle and go fishing in the heaven.
Morning, folks. Welcome back to the Bruce Dickey Show here on AM 1390 WFIW-FM, Fairfield, Illinois. We are up to August 15th, 1920, I think.
August 16th.
August 16th, 1920. My guest across the way is Matt Vaughn. He is a chronicler of our times and times past. Well, you were saying.
It's August 16, 1920. It's a rainy and dark afternoon at the Polo Grounds in New York City, high in the upper 80s, very humid. The talk of the town was the humidity in the pennant race. A light rain began to fall right when Carl Mays is finishing his warm-up pitches.
So early.
He's starting for the Yankees,
okay.
By the fifth inning, the rain had stopped. Ray Chapman leads off the fifth inning. Cleveland's ahead 3-0 in this very important game.
How many games were left in the season, you remember?
They played until late September that year.
Okay, all right.
With a count of one ball and one strike, Chapman, as usual, is hunched over the plate. It was his habit to kind of rock backward a little bit as the pitch is being delivered.
Backward toward the dugout or backward toward the umpire?
Catcher.
Which way back? Backward
to the catcher.
Okay.
And this was, oftentimes he did this in order to lay down a bunt. Carl Mays, the clever and crafty and angry Carl Mays, sees that he's doing this. And in mid-delivery, he thinks Ray Chapman's getting ready to lay down a bunt. If you're Carl Mays and Ray Chapman's laying down a bunt, you're the best bunter in the league, what are you going to do, Bruce, if you're a pitcher? What are you going to throw?
In.
You're going to go high and tight.
High and tight.
You're going to go high and tight, and you're going to bring the heat.
You're going to bring heat, you're going high and tight, because you want to make sure that the bunt is unsuccessful.
That's right, and that's exactly what Carl Mays attempted to do. A gray, not a white blur, passed through the afternoon on its way to the home plate, through the heavy, humid air. Maybe it's a strike, maybe it's a not. There's a different accounts on this. It's going towards Ray Chapman's head. Ray Chapman did not move by almost all accounts.
Never saw it.
This was the pitch that killed. The ball crashed into the left temple of Ray Chapman. Many of the 20,000 fans at the Polo Grounds heard an explosive sound. Babe Ruth, who's in right field, said he heard it. A sports writer who's on the lower press box, about 50 feet behind the umpire, described it as, quote, a sickening thud, unquote. It causes a 3.5-inch fracture in Ray Chapman's skull, which extends to the base of the left side of his skull from the temple area. The ball bounces off his forehead, dribbles out towards home or the pitcher's mound. Carl Mays thinks the ball has hit a bat. He fields the ball and throws to the Yankee first baseman for the out. He didn't realize that it had hit the head of Ray Chapman. He thought it was a ball in play.
And just for those who don't know, at this time there were no helmets.
No batting helmets.
This was just, you're wearing your cap.
Trivia, Bruce, who's the Yankee first baseman who fielded that ball?
1920, Wally Pipp.
Absolutely, that's who it was, the predecessor of Lou Gehrig. Pipp is throwing the ball around the infield thinking that the batter has been retired when he looks towards home plate and sees that Chapman is sunk to his knees, his face is contorted, there's blood coming from his left ear. The Yankee catcher, Muddy Ruel, tried to catch Chapman as his knees buckled. The umpire ran towards the grandstand and yelled something.
Scoot back.
What did he yell, Bruce?
The umpire ran toward the grandstand and yelled something? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Get a doctor.
Is there a doctor in the house? Tris Speaker rushed over from the on-deck circle to help him. Speaker thought at the time that Ray Chapman's trying to get to his feet so he can rush the mound and clobber Carl Mays. Two doctors arrive on the scene, one of them from the Yankees. They apply ice to Chapman. He is revived. They gather around him, all the players. Chapman shrugs off assistance, walks under his own power across the infield towards the clubhouse in center field. But around second base, his knees gave way. Two teammates grabbed him, helped carry him into the clubhouse. At this time, while this is going on, Mays is trying to plead his case to the umpire, saying that the pitch sailed on him and that the ball had been roughed up due to some other reason, not his own. He's trying to plead his case.
Tell the umpire, well, plead what case? I mean,
that he didn't intentionally try to throw it in his head.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Carl Mays. The game resumed.
Mays knew
when he saw the blood.
The desperation of the situation.
He knew there was bad times ahead. He took the mound, pitched the 6th, 7th, and 8th inning, lifted for a pinch hitter in the 8th inning. Cleveland wins the game 4-3. Ray Chapman's taken to the nearest hospital. While he's riding up the elevator with a teammate or former teammate in the hospital, he says, quote, "John, for God's sake, don't call Kate. But if you do, tell her I'm all right," unquote. These were the last words from Ray Chapman.
No kidding.
Surgeries performed to try to remove the pressure on the brain from the base of the skull. His wife, Kathleen, is summoned from Cleveland. Ray Chapman rallied in the early morning hours, but died the next morning at 4:40 a.m.
She get there in time?
Before she arrived. When given the news, she fainted upon hearing about the death of her husband. By 10 a.m., a Yankee staff person is sent to the apartment of Carl Mays to tell him Ray Chapman's dead. He knocks on the door. Carl Mays answers the door, gives the news to Mays. Mays closes the door in his face.
Doesn't say a word.
Doesn't say a word, and retires into his apartment. The Yankees then send over another person. Do you want to guess who the Yankees sent over?
Not Babe Ruth.
No.
Okay, give me a second.
Think like me for a moment, Bruce.
They're not going to send, is it the owner? No.
They send over a lawyer.
They send over an attorney.
Which is another reason to hate the Yankees if you didn't have one before.
I got to tell you, that's plenty.
They send over a lawyer, and the lawyer says, "We're going to the DA's office, and you're going to give a statement." He does exactly that. When he's giving the statement in the DA's office in Manhattan, he has some remorse by this time. Tears fill his eyes. He claimed Ray Chapman tried to duck downward to get away from the ball. The DA chose not to interview anybody else in the investigation of this matter, closed the books on it. There was no prosecution for any malicious intent here or any other crime. The DA ruled that it was an accident, which it probably was, closed the investigation at that point. Carl Mays was allowed to go home. When he got home, his wife had told him, "You've already received 2 threatening phone calls." He considered going to the funeral home in New York City where Ray Chapman's body was being stored prior to being transported in train back to Cleveland. And he said he wouldn't do that. He said, quote, "I knew that the sight of his silent form would haunt me as long as I live." Across Major League Baseball the next day, sorrows turned to anger.
Oh, yeah.
There's talks of boycott.
Yeah.
The two teams leading the boycott movement, the Indians, of course.
The Indians and the White Sox.
The Indians and the Boston Red Sox.
Oh, the Red Sox.
They hate Carl Mays from last season.
Okay. All right.
Ty Cobb's in the middle of this. The boycott came to nothing. Basically, the owners leaned on these guys. Don't boycott this. This is a pennant race. We got to finish the season. After the death of Ray Chapman, the Indians stumbled. But thereafter, they won 24 of their last 32 games. Very late in the season, the Indians had a 1-game lead over the White Sox when news came down about the indictment I mentioned earlier. Charlie Comiskey, the pompous owner for the White Sox, suspended the 7 players on the White Sox who were still on the team. There were 8 indicted.
Right.
Chick Gandel was no longer on the team. The Indians go on to win the pennant by 2 games because the White Sox are not fielding
White
a complete
Sox can't,
team.
Yeah, White Sox can't field a team.
The Indians go on to play the Brooklyn Robins, sometimes known as the Dodgers.
Later known as the Dodgers.
That's right. In the 1920 World Series, they win the World Series 5-2. Then it was a best-of-9 affair. And the team awarded Mrs. Ray Chapman a winner's share from the World Series.
At least they could do.
Ray Chapman's dream of bringing a world title to Cleveland was realized. Kathleen Chapman never attended another Major League Baseball game for the rest of her life. 6 months after Ray was killed, she gives birth to a daughter, which she named Ray, R-A-E.
Oh, my God.
Kathleen Chapman was never the same after Ray
you
was think?
Killed.
In 1928, Kathleen Chapman died under very mysterious circumstances.
Well, the daughter's 7 years old.
The family claimed she accidentally poisoned herself. The Cleveland newspapers reported otherwise, stating that it was a suicide and that she had recently recovered from a nervous breakdown. The coroner's report lists her death, or cause of death, as suicide. 6 months later, after Kathleen probably killed herself, the now 8-year-old Ray Marie Chapman contracted measles and died.
Aren't you just a festival of pleasant information? Merry Christmas, everybody.
It gets worse.
It can't get worse.
Ray's mother back in Heron shut herself off from the world. She became an introvert. She was a very outgoing person.
So Ray, the daughter had measles and passed away, right?
Yes.
Measles and passed away. Okay.
Ray's mother back in Heron shut herself off from the world, fell into a deep depression. Ray's then 15-year-old sister commented years later, quote, Ray was her favorite. He always was her favorite. But that was okay. He was everyone's favorite.
Well, I see. Now that's cool. Ray would have been, what, 29?
Yes, when he was killed. He was 29.
The
question that arises is, why don't we talk about this more in terms of Southern Illinois history and everything? Because it's kind of a big deal. Well, I think I have a reason, though. For all I know, I'm the first person to come up with this. Maybe somebody else has. I don't know. Following the death of Ray Chapman, there were ominous events in Williamson County and Heron area that kind of overshadowed.
You had the burger trial and the burger hanging and all that kind of stuff.
Worse than that, in June of 1922, there was the infamous Heron Mine Massacre. The very mine where Ray Chapman's father worked, there was this huge dispute between non-union and union employees. Three union miners were killed. Three union miners were killed in a confrontation with striking union members and non-union members. The next day, union miners gathered and killed 19 of 50 strike breakers and guards at this mine I mentioned in Heron. And these were not just shootings. These were brutal and heinous deaths. Some were shot and then strung up by
beatings,
a rope.
And that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was a horrible thing. President Harding called it a, quote, shocking crime, barbarity, butchery, rot, and madness. There were never any prosecutions for these murders in connection with the Heron Mine Massacre. In the spring of 1923, the KKK takes hold in Williamson County.
Oh,
they began to organize. The head of the KKK was the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, S. Glenn Young, who, depending on your point of view, was either a righteous Christian man or a terrorist. Think John Brown. I know your opinion of John
Brown.
You
do know my opinion of John Brown. I think I've told you before.
And I tend to agree.
Dirty terrorist.
Well, I don't know if Mr. Young has relatives in Southern Illinois, so I'll leave it at that, at the risk of defaming.
I'm talking about John Brown.
I'm talking about S. Glenn Young.
Okay.
Glenn Young was gunned down in 1925 in the famous cigar store shootout in Heron, which left four other people dead. He was shot by a deputy from Williamson County. 15,000 people attended S. Glenn Young's funeral.
Wow.
Shortly thereafter, Charlie Berger and the Shelton gang joined forces to take on the Klan. Back then, the Klan was not so much anti-African-American
Anti-Catholic.
Anti-Catholic, anti-foreigner, anti-booze. And when you look at the monument for the victims of the Heron Mine Massacre, who were strike breakers, called scabs by the union people, there's a photo on the internet. If you want to go to it, you can look at it and list their place of birth. A lot of these folks are born in Eastern Europe, Russia, that sort of place. They came over, Italy. They came over with mine experience to Heron. And they came over wanting to drink, and the Klan didn't cotton to that. Anyway, Charlie Berger and the Shelton gang, the Klan's kind of bad for business.
Oh, sure.
They join forces.
They're drinkers.
They take on the Klan.
Bootleggers.
Several shootings ensue. They broke the back of the Klan.
This is fascinating. This is just fascinating.
Charlie Berger's arrested for the murder of West City Mayor Joe Adams in 27, executed in 1928. Contrary to popular view, he was not the last public execution in Illinois. That was somebody else, but he was next to last.
Really?
And when you look at all this stuff, what's called Bloody Williamson, it obscures the Ray Chapman situation because suddenly this poor kid, 29-year-old kid, being killed in a Major League Baseball game is rather insignificant when you're in the middle of Bloody Williamson.
You look at the rest of Heron taking a beating.
After the death of Ray Chapman, there are rule changes. And the rule changes, which everybody agrees to enforce now, is we got to replace these balls more often. The new rule then imposed was when the ball becomes dirty, replace it, regardless if it costs $2.50 or not. What does every big league hitter say to a reporter when he's on a hitting streak, Bruce? What does he say?
The ball looks like a beach ball.
I can see the ball well.
I can see the ball.
You have a white ball now.
Yeah.
Which is much easier to hit than a brown ball. The numbers for the home runs go up. Ray Chapman's death had an influence on the end of the dead ball era.
See, now, I had never really thought about that part of it.
We talk about the shiner ball and the
new
ball.
They always talk about a new ball.
Yeah. But in terms of replacing balls, that was implemented after the death of Ray Chapman.
Wow. So Babe Ruth becoming the star that he did is possibly part and parcel with the new balls.
In 19, I think Ruth had like 43 home runs or thereabouts. Yeah. Don't quote me on that. So it was starting to pick up then.
Yeah.
But other more average ball players can hit for power when you can see the ball, the white ball coming in.
So my question then, you go ahead and finish your conclusion before we get out.
Carl Mays. What happened to Carl Mays? He played until 1929. There is compelling evidence in my mind, Bruce, that Carl Mays, who pitched in the 1921 World Series, conspired with gamblers to throw the games in which he pitched.
Oh, really?
And I'm not the only person that thinks that. That's documented. He retired in 29. He had invested his life savings in the stock market, $175,000 worth. The crash happened in October of 29. He lost his life savings. He had to go pitch again. No major league team would take him because his skills had diminished. He spent 2 years in the minor leagues. Pitchers with lesser numbers were inducted into the Hall of Fame than Carl Mays. But one longtime member of the Veterans Committee made a comment that every year his petition was brought for consideration into the Hall of Fame. He was blackballed, not so much for what he did to Ray Chapman, but in conjunction with the Ray Chapman incident and him throwing the 21 World Series
in
the two or three games that he pitched.
That's pretty cool.
He died in 1971.
No kidding.
Yeah.
My thought, my question after the whole, after what you've said here is did the Ray Chapman, has the Ray Chapman death placed a pox on Williamson County? Can we call it a curse?
There were incidents of vendettas and the type that occurred in the late 19th century in Williamson County between all sorts of factions. It's a very tumultuous place even now.
Oh, wow.
There's angry people down there now.
There certainly are. Matt, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. That was a fascinating story. Thank you again so much.
Thank you, Bruce. We've had fun.
I had fun. Even though it's just a terrible story, Matt Vaughn.
Merry Christmas, Bruce.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening, folks. We'll talk to you all next week or next month. Have a great day.